It's our podcast birthday, and I brought gifts. We discussed the relationship between the NBA and sports gambling, Dante Exum's trip back from basketball purgatory, and a whole lot more coming up right now on this episode of No Cap Room. Hello, friends. Welcome to No Cap Room. My name is Jake Fisher, senior NBA reporter at Yahoo Sports. Joining me, as always, senior NBA writer for Yahoo Sports. It is my man. It is your man. It is everyone's man. It's Dan Devine. What is up?
Jake, I am thrilled to be able to speak about the NBA with you today. I am concerned that nobody has me and you in their parlays, and I think we're going to have to ratchet that up. We're going to have to generate more interest in us in terms of the action. We got to get people sweating when they listen to the show.
Yeah, we're going to talk some gambling, genie out of the bottle, rabbit out of the hat type stuff. But first, and this is not in the rundown, I'm going off script. This is the last No Cap Room before I turn 30. So I just wanted to admit that to the public and to Dan, being all the flack I've given him for being an old man over the years. This is it.
How does it feel? Do you feel like you're dying inside a little bit? Are you hearing like wistful songs in your head? Is there like a montage of memories of youth going by? Like, where are you at mentally in this situation?
I feel pretty good, honestly. I think I've kind of felt in like the 30 mindset and body since I was 27, 28. So
what's the 30 mindset this 41-year-old wants to
just
know?
Just like, I'm not a child anymore. I like have a pretty established career. I have a pretty adult romantic partnership with like future plans to be working in that career to achieve and not, and taking care of my doing things today to better myself tomorrow. That's kind of where we've been at for a little bit now. More yoga, more, I drink kombucha every morning now for that gut health. You know, it's been going.
That's good. Well, listen, gut health is critical. I think we all, if there's one thing that No Cap Room has always espoused, it's gut health. I think for whatever it's worth, Jake, I'll always consider you a child. Don't worry about it.
Thank you. Well, look, I didn't come unprepared. I brought a gift that I want to share with the class that I received, and then I have a gift technically for Dan. So,
okay.
Which one would you like first?
Let's share with the class. What did you want to bring for everybody?
So when I was at Madison Square Garden in November for James Harden's debut, I was like, oh, I like those sneakers. One of his Adidas guys said, oh, yeah, we'll get you those. No problem. Took about 4 months, but we finally have a nice James Harden Volume 8 spaceship looking motherfucker. I'm just going to go for it. They're the weirdest, wildest. I love these shoes, though. Like, I'm so happy I have one in my possession.
Okay,
gift for you.
So I guess it's good to know that I don't have those coming to me, but all right, what do I have coming to me?
So I was cleaning out some things in the closet and
always
I found
a good start. My garbage, I thought of Dan.
No. This is good. So I think we've shouted out Andrew Unterberger, A, you get off my gold on the show before.
That's right.
Editor in chief of RightsRickySanchez.com. The purveyor, I guess, the originator of the nickname Sauce Castillo, who was watching a Kings game, saw the closed captioning. You know, what happened from there is this bottle of Sauce Castillo that I have that it expired. It was best by April 20th, 2017. But Dan, if you'd like me to get this to you sometime, it's for you, man. I thought I would do that for you.
I really appreciate it. Like, what is the how do we best evaluate Jake's feelings toward me in this partnership? 7-year-old expired food is,
wow, that
is
was
where
7
it's
years ago now.
I know, dog. Like, well, it's also shouts out to Nick Stauskas. That was who Sauce Castillo was
for sure.
So
great interview for my book. He was awesome. We talked for like an hour and a half. Love that guy.
Yeah, by all accounts a wonderful individual and wore the nickname well. You know, seemed to be all right about it. But well, that is thoughtful, Jake. I mean, I guess any sort of blog era jokes make good gifts for me.
Yeah.
But if it wound up like buried in the back of your closet, I don't know that it's going to aspire to a place of prominence around here. I don't have a whole lot more space than you do. So we'll see. But this is good. We come bearing gifts. What a
we
nice
like,
start. And especially this year, this is a year. Like, we started this podcast feed, the Ball Don't Lie podcast feed, March 20th, 2023, Vinny Goodwill and Bomani Jones. And then a couple days after that, it's me and you. So this is like our birthday show. I didn't get you anything.
It's okay.
But it's okay. The way I like to put it, Jake, is that my presence is a present. So you're welcome.
There you go. There you go. I would like super producer John Gennaro to fact check whether Nick Stassi's career expired before this bottle, but I don't think it did. I think Nick outlasted the league. April 20th, 2017. While John looks that up, we'll get back onto task with the news of the week. And last, I believe, no, I think, but it was 2 weeks before because I was in Miami last week. 2 weeks ago, we lamented all the injury news popping up across the league. Donovan Mitchell, man, he has sustained a nasal fracture, the latest of all the injury reporting this year that has gotten super specific about metatarsals and other stuff. Broken nose, right? That's what this is. Donovan Mitchell about to get a nose job. But
yeah, when you look at how it happened, because I went and I was like, oh, I actually missed the play when it happened. It happens with Tristan Thompson going for a rebound and just like people's elbowing him in the nose. So like, I don't know that it's more complicated than broken nose, but yes, nasal fracture is maybe the artisanal version.
John is confirming that Nick Stauskas did outlast the bottle. He played 21-22 with Boston and Miami. So shout out to Sauce Castillo again. Yeah, man, I think back to task. We've talked about it with your Darius Garland thing from the very, very beginning of the year. Donovan's been in and out of the lineup. Yeah, you know, Mobley's been in and out of the lineup. There was all this talk in the preseason about JB Bickerstaff being on the hot seat before they turn the corner and they move forward to be the real third seed in the East right now. Like I don't think this is like just by default of New York and Philly having, and like, sure, that helped a lot, but the Cavs went out there and took this thing. They went on that 11-12, whatever it was, game winning streak without two of their top four players. This is not a hatery thing. This is an empathy thing. I'm starting to get worried for the people, the good people of Northeast Ohio, for the Kelsey brothers and everyone else, that the Cavs might just be doomed, man. They seem to have like a spook going around. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I mean, the framing on it, you know, you're right. You know, you notice it's not just Donovan Mitchell being out now. It's Max Strus missed the last 9 games with a knee strain. Evan Mobley's been out, as you mentioned, with a sprained left ankle. Dean Wade missed the last handful of games, too. So they've had like multiple rotation pieces out at the same time for most of the last several months. And they've powered through that to a large degree. And, you know, Donovan Mitchell was a giant part of that in December and January heading up to the trade deadline, which is why up to the All-Star break, rather. Which is why he was, I had him as an All-Star starter. He made the game. He was in position to be an All-NBA player, fringe MVP candidate that people were started talking about when they were at their hottest. And now he's going to fall short of the 65-game threshold for year-end award consideration. And that's a bummer in, you know, one vein where it's like this guy's playing maybe the best basketball of his career. The other side of it, though, is they have been, so to your point about them being sort of unlucky, I actually did a little reporting on this, Jake. I don't know if you know this about reporting. I reached out to Jeff Stotts from In Street Clothes, who is like the injury guy, you know, at In Street Clothes on Twitter, instreetclothes.com. You should absolutely check out his work. He's second to none when it comes to
the
explaining.
The one Twitter doctor that we trust.
Yes, when it comes to, physical trainer, athletic trainer. Athletic trainer is the term for it. But he is great at explaining what these injuries are, what the general prognosis is, and then has a database of going back with injuries of like, this is how long this kind of injury typically takes to come back from, yada, yada, yada. I asked him, like, are they particularly unlucky this year? Where are they in terms of their injuries this season? And as of the March 18th, so a couple days ago, Cleveland had lost 184 games, player games lost. That's the 11th most in the league. It's 7th most in the East. So not like overwhelmingly, you know, injury racked. The team that's had the worst luck with that is the Memphis Grizzlies, have lost 418 player games. That's more than twice as many as Cleveland. And it's the gap between them and number two, which is the Hornets, is as large as the gap between number two and number 15. Like, the Grizzlies have just lost everybody, with the exception of Jaren Jackson Jr., basically, all season. And so they are head and shoulders above that. But when it comes to postseason teams, yeah, the Cavs are like one of the more injury-ravaged teams in that mix. The Sixers losing Embiid has been an issue. You know, the Heat have had guys in and out. Jimmy Butler's missed a bunch of time. Bam Adebayo's missed a bunch of time, et cetera. But they have really been damaged by this. And it's put them in a position now where, yes, they're still third in the East, but that's slipping, man. 7-9 since the All-Star break. They're now just one game up in the loss column on the Knicks, only two up on the Magic. Pretty much every projection system you look at now sees them as falling out of two behind my Milwaukee into three, and is giving both the Knicks and the Magic still like an outside shot of getting up into three. So it's they've been hard, like a hard luck team at precisely the wrong time for it, and it could wind up being, you know, a season that looked had such great promise, and where it looked like they had solved some of the problems that really plagued them during the first round of the playoffs. You know, they might not even get the chance to kind of prove it.
Which, just like we could say for 7, 8, 9, maybe all 16 teams that end up making the playoffs, there's just they're going to be, we've been saying this, there are going to be stakes for all these teams that have championship aspirations, for teams that want to get out of the first round, for teams that want to get out of the second round, that if they don't, not to be the doomsdayer, just always looking forward to the offseason guy, but that is the overall context and landscape that does set the backdrop for a lot of these people who are actually on the ground doing the things, playing the games, coaching on the sidelines, trying to figure out how to move this thing forward deeper into the postseason. So it just, there's going to be all that extra element is going to add more flavor to me for the postseason. Detroit not in the playoff picture. They lose Star Thompson.
Just a bit outside of the playoff picture, the Detroit Pistons.
They lose Star Thompson to a blood clot. He'll be out the rest of the season. Get well soon, Star Thompson, my fellow twin. Isaiah Stewart, arguably the owner of the best nickname in the league, also missing the season with a hamstring strain. And I think it'll be good for Isaiah Stewart to kind of reset and move on past this year. Not exactly, for all of Detroit, but for him in particular, I think new contract kicks in, start things fresh. Who knows? He was a super, targeted trade piece that didn't get moved, but a lot of teams had interest. And we talked about New Orleans and Boston and what have you. Who's to say what could happen for anyone in Detroit? But I think my best wish is to Beef Stew, turning the page, fresh start, new beginnings, whether in Detroit or elsewhere.
Well, yeah, I mean, this was the year, outside of the getting into, you know, fights and stuff, like that's not a great set of
fight
circumstances,
singular. But we need to be accurate. Fight singular.
Fight singular. Yes, fair enough. I apologize. The multi-year project of saying we're going to turn you into a stretch big who can switch stuff, like that kind of worked this year. Like, I think around like 38% from three on career high volume, like that starting lineup or in the core that they've put together begs for shooting. And he's doing it. Like, he can shoot. Cade has been shooting well for the last few months. That's kind of it, though. You know, like, if you're going to try to play Stewart at the four with Jalen Duren, like, he's got a space. They've got to find an answer there. If you're going to try to play Asar Thompson and Jaden Ivey, or if you're going to try to play Ivey and Cade together, the shooting has to come along. And that's the thing I want to sort of hit with Asar Thompson. Yes, his jump shot is a problem. It's not there. Neither him nor his brother Amen are at that place in terms of their development yet. That dude does everything else at a good or better level, though. Up in the top 10 or 15 in pretty much every category among rookies, it's 28% outside of 5 feet. Not what you're looking for. But when you look at like the block rate, the steal rate, the defensive rebounding rate, the assist rate, like the rookies that have done that kind of stuff, it's like Jokic, rookie Ben Simmons, Alvin Adams with the Suns back in the day. and him and his brother and Wembanyama. Like, that's it. It's also weird that three of those guys came in the same year. But like, you have a player that can already do so much at such a high level, defends everybody, like event creating defender. If this is the opportunity for him to kind of like take a step back, get healthy, obviously, number one, but then throw everything that they've got in their developmental program at working out that jumper, you know, the sky really could be the limit for Asar Thompson, and he could be the kind of piece that could help change the trajectory in Detroit, which has not really been ascendant for quite some time.
One thing that I think has and will continue to truly change the trajectory of the NBA at large is what we mentioned at the top, the like full absolute wrapping their arms around gambling that's been going on pretty much since the very beginning of Adam Silver's tenure taking over as commissioner back in 2014. I remember those very early quotes. I forget exactly where they were, when they were, and who they should be attributed to. So apologies to whatever outlet. I mean, he said it in a press conference, but Silver took everyone and put him on full blast when he said something to the effect of like, the NBA needs to figure out ways to monetize our, like, ourselves off of all this stuff. And if you're listening to this show, you're probably very, very familiar with how all this has unfolded over the last 4 to 5 years, right? State by state, gambling became more and more legalized. There was the whole battle between, you know, all these apps and websites about, are they games of skill versus chance and what have you. But now we're pretty at the future. Like, if the flying cars and we'll have watches and have holograms on our wrists was like what everyone always expected the future to be, like, put that in gambling, like, we actually have arrived there. Mike Vorkunov of The Athletic, friend of the show, I don't know if he's friend of yours, friend of mine,
I like him enough, he's a nice guy.
Shout out Vork, who reported at The Athletic, I believe it was he, for that's how I first saw it, on Tuesday, that the NBA is going to be infusing gambling directly into the League Pass app that still doesn't work half the time that I use it in my apartment. So that's a whole nother podcast to complain about that. But then you have Cavs coach JB Bickerstaff telling reporters that he's had his phone number procured by gamblers who sent him threatening crazy messages, to use a direct quote, about where him and his kids live. And Tyrese Halliburton is saying that he feels like a prop because half the world just looks at him as someone who can make them money on DraftKings or FanDuel or what have you. Spo said it's contradictory, that it treads on a weird line. They had an incident with Victor Oladipo last year where someone was screaming at him and security had to take him away. I get the like over under fun and bad beats on SVP at the end of the night, on like that type of stuff has always kind of been like, I get it. Betting the line and guessing that. And there, of course, there's been stuff dating back to Shoeless Joe Jackson about how, you know, there's always going to be some type of opportunity for someone to do something funny. But the fact that we're getting so granular with all this stuff, and that you can, if it's in the app and like someone, and I'll tell you what, all these players are on their phones at halftime. That's something that I'm not just talking about that from a gambling perspective. I've been so surprised. Maybe I said this on the show, I don't recall. I've been so surprised going in the locker rooms pregame and postgame now, just to see how many players are just sitting in their chair, hunched over, nose buried in their screen. And from all the coaches that I know, they do it at halftime too. And it used to be like a sanctuary. Like, you go into the locker room, you're here, you're plugged in. These kids are all scrolling on social. They've got 7 different people messaging them things they got to do better in the first half. There's plenty of opportunity for, you know, this to wade into this gambling conversation that we're having now. So I'm going to stop talking. Dan, I'm going to pitch it over to you. I don't know. What's your first thought on all this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, my first thought is that when you talk about Adam Silver being sort of clear at the beginning of his tenure that this is, like, everybody else is kind of making money off this, we need to make money off it. There is a large pool of money out there, and we need to be accessing it and maximizing it. You know, you pay your money and you take your chances. And this is the kind of stuff that can come from it. Like, you're absolutely right to note this is not acknowledging the relationship between professional sports or between sports in general and gambling on sports. Like, pretending it didn't exist, it doesn't exist or never existed would be ridiculous. Like, but it, there's, I think there's probably a difference in degree, at least, if not kind, from Brent Musburger at the end of a game saying, like, or Al Michaels saying, like, and some interested parties are watching this kick, as opposed to, like, it is in front of your face constantly. And now with the new partnership the NBA is pursuing, able to make two clicks in your app to get your account that is, you know, connected to your credit card to, you know, to make a bet. And like, we are to some degree related to this or complicit in this, right? Like, Yahoo has a sports book at the Venetian in Vegas. Like, the podcasts that go, I don't know about in terms of our programmatic ads, but like, you cannot listen to a sports podcast without hearing some kind of read for or some kind of promotion for a sports book or a gambling app or some other sort of wagering concern. The money that comes from that is fueling tons of these relationships, right? It's across major shops. And so if you work for that, you work for one of those places and you take a check from one of those places, you are to some degree complicit in it. And I can't pretend that that's not true. And I can't pretend I love that. I try not to do a whole hell of a lot of like wagering related stuff in my work, but like, we have people who do that at a really high level here. And so it makes all of this feel more, not complicated is kind of a cop out. It makes it feel a little bit gross, and it makes you feel like the level of concern of, like, as JB Bickerstaff was talking about, as Tyrese Halliburton is talking about, Eric Spoelstra, the people that you mentioned, like, there's not a large gap or a big bright dividing line or a high wall between somebody who is aggrieved in this way and the people who are playing these games or coaching these games or on the staffs of the teams. Like, I get nervous about a lot of things. I'm a nervous person. But like, when you know, we used to see like fans run on the court to go high five LeBron or whatever. Like,
yeah.
What if that guy was pissed off that he didn't hit his same game parlay and something real bad could happen with that, right? Like, I have concerns about stuff like that. Maybe that's, you know, you might consider that pearl clutching. You might consider that sort of like worst case scenario thinking. Maybe. But it feels like the degree to which everybody has sort of fully embraced the money of this gotten on board for whatever consequences might be coming down the pike for it because it's worth the dollar today, like that. Yeah, I have some concerns about that, and I don't feel particularly great about it. I also don't have a particularly great answer for it unless somebody completely moral and independently wealthy wants to fund all of our operations. So,
well, I'm reading this book called The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt, all about moral psychology. So once I'm finished, I will definitely have the answer for you.
Yes.
But no, I don't think it's pearl clutching, because like, in college basketball right now, the high school group chat that listeners are familiar with, the Philly boys, a lot of them went to Temple. They've been laughing about how Temple has this point shaving scandal and now they're doing well in March Madness, blah, blah, blah. It's not basketball, but the biggest star in baseball, Shohei Ohtani's interpreter I don't want to digress too much, but like, if you haven't heard about that, go look into the $4.5 million that are in question about, I mean, that could happen with anyone here. And the conspiracy theories flying around about what could be the reality there of, is this interpreter just like taking the fall for whatever. So to me, if you want to just like try to just not complain and like narrow in exactly what the issue is here, to me, it's the minute to minute, second to second live betting stuff that I think is like the yuckiest part about it, that the league is clearly steering into with this League Pass edition, that I think from my vantage point is the scariest, weirdest, and probably has the like the damage for or the danger for the most damage. Going back to that halftime stuff I was referring to, even just like you could go back on the bench, like Spo was talking about with Victor Oladipo, or I'm sure even, you know, it's happened across the league. You go back to the bench, if you're a star or whatever, starter, someone who typically sits the start of the fourth quarter until that first TV timeout, you're coming back in like the 9 minute mark of the fourth. And that whole time on the bench, someone behind you is talking about how you are a rebound away from this line, or like you're a point. And, you know, some players will be happy to like, oh, that's a joke. Like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander chasing that 30 point, whatever, not to call out Shai. I'm saying that type of thing could happen, just like guys chase triple doubles and chase, oh, this is my fifth 30 point triple double night, like that type of stuff. I mean, especially if they're somewhat, like you talked about Memphis losing all these games, like a team that has a bunch of 10-day guys on it that are just trying to make their livelihood happen, like you could pretty quickly make some funky stuff go down. So that, to me, it's the live stuff, and like the fact that it will be in the arena happening, like it's very different than like a future bet on who's going to win rookie of the year or who's going to win a division, who's going to make the conference, that type of stuff. That type, like when it is chancy things, when it is just like a true gamble, that to me is different than the minute to minute live updating. Oh, like when I was in Denver, what was it? That Monday. So like a week and a half ago, when they were down 22 at the half to Toronto, whenever it was, Adam Mares, shout out Adam, turned to me and said, hey, Denver's plus 100 right now to win this game. Like, it's a pretty good bet, right? And not to blame that, I was like, yeah, like honestly, if I was a betting man, take that. Like, they're going to win this game. Like, to me, that is so much different that, like, that's just like a fun, can Denver overcome a 22 point deficit than like all these nitty gritty live update things that are even like individual player controlled, as opposed to, or even like the line for the half, as opposed to just like, will this team win? Will this guy get this award? That's to me a little bit of a line of demarcation that I'm thinking about and feeling.
Yeah, I will be perfectly honest with you. Like, I have plenty of vices and we can talk about them as much as you want, but this is not one of them.
Give me one.
I like to drink a lot. I like to, I used to smoke cigarettes. I don't do it anymore. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I eat too much. I don't sleep very well. I don't know. We could talk about a lot of things. It's not my area of expertise. Let's put it that way. As far as like slicing up what is a better version of this, a worse version of it, a more healthy relation, I don't know. I wouldn't be speaking from any kind of, you know, information there. The potential downsides of it seem pretty dangerous to me. The parties involved here have just looked at all of it and said the upside of what we can make off of this and capitalize on the interest in it is worth that. And it's worth our while. It's worth it to the bottom line. It's worth it to the, you know, increasing basketball related income that grows the pie of the league and gets everybody paid more. It's worth it. And then, you know, on the media side as well, you know, it's worth it to all of us for this to get as big as it can. And a lot of times a mindset of let's make this as big as it can winds up leaving some people by the wayside in pretty dire straits. So we'll see. I don't know. Yeah, I look at this and I think like this is going to, something bad is going to happen here. But I guess, like, as I said earlier, maybe I think like that too much about everything.
We'll take a quick break, pay some bills, and when we come back, we'll be sunnier and cheerier and more optimistic about the future of the NBA. Welcome back to No Cap Room here on the Ball Don't Lie podcast. Dante Exum. We talked a lot of Mavericks last week. I spoke to Dante a couple weeks back when the Mavericks were in town in Brooklyn. We had a lovely chat. Very charming man. happy to see him back in the NBA. But it really is like a remarkable story. Like he said to me, almost, this is almost a direct quote. You take a risk when you go to Europe. Very few players come back. And he's not wrong. And a lot of those players end up coming back and not really factoring at all. Think of Josh Childress when he dipped out during the lockout. I even think of so many top tier EuroLeague guys who come play in the league. Sonny Weems, who was a CSKA Moscow like legend before the Phoenix Suns signed him. I believe that was 2015-16. He was then, very big tangent here, he was then traded to the Sixers, the process Sixers at that trade deadline, when all those players who were on 10-day contracts that could have benefited from gambling we were talking about earlier, they were waiting for the shortfall money to be, if the Sixers came, now the new CBA has eradicated this, every team has to be above the salary floor before the season starts. But back then, if you didn't get there, the team had to then split up the money that was left. And the Sixers had like $3 million short of that floor. Every player was ready for it. Then the Sixers traded for Sonny Weems' $3 million salary that put them over the floor and waived him like 3 weeks later to keep that money out of Ishmael's pocket. So
brutal.
But yeah, few guys come back and are good. Few guys come back and get injured for a little while and could then come back from that injury and look to be the maybe third most valuable player on that team that has legitimate contending aspirations in the Western Conference, depending on what night you watch them, and shoot 50% from three, albeit on a very small 80 attempt sample size, but is their best perimeter defender. The numbers that I will pull up after I pitch this over to Dan with on-off splits of him, Kyrie, and Luka are staggering for how much they show what Exum means to this team. And he's only on a $3 million deal that Dallas is absolutely going to pick up for next year, which he'll then be 29 going into free agency with a pretty good opportunity to make another big deal happen and come to life. So there's more to say, but for now, Dan Devine, are you as pumped about Dante Exum's return as I am?
Well, I mean, I'm pumped in that it's cool to see him back. I don't have anything weighing on it where like you just put out a big feature. Like, so you are more invested than me in its ongoing success. So you can be like, see, check out this cool story I did with this great access that I got. So you have more invested in that. But yeah, I was thinking about him in the context, you mentioned just his age, that it's still like on the right side of 30, has not had a whole ton of basketball on his body because he's been hurt in and out. So like there's an aspect of him sort of like entering his prime a little bit, even though he's been around and like in the conversation and then out of sight, out of mind, over in Europe and back. When he came into the draft, it was like, that was when there was like the international man of mystery kind of thing in all these drafts. And we don't have that as much anymore because you are getting greater exposure to the international prospects
earlier. Four of the top five picks in this draft could be non-American players.
Yeah. So like, this is not the days of Exum or like Porzingis where it's like, no one's seen this guy. Who knows? You know, God forbid Giannis, a second division Greek guy. Right. So, but there was still some aspect of that where you're like, all right, but like a guard, and is he a point guard? Is he a combo guard? Is he going to be like a number one scorer? What's he going to look like? How is he going to play? And it never coalesced in quite the way that you wanted to see it in Utah, in part because like he had that major, I think it was ACL, right? Like a major knee injury.
Playing against, ironically enough, Luka's Slovenian national team in summer play, like went into the paint, knee buckled, torn ACL, done. Played 66 games as a third-year player. Then preseason, TJ Warren accidentally flew into him, separated shoulder, 14 games that year. Like, it really never got started.
Yeah, and you would see these flashes. Like, the memory I have of him in Utah was he was the only guy that had a prayer of staying in front of Harden when it was those, like, the Rockets-Jazz series, and he was the only on-ball defender that could actually deal with him. But the defense was great, and you could see that fitting in a playoffs on a playoff team. The shot wasn't there, and like the playmaking, he was like a more of a complimentary playmaker than a number one guy. So then he goes over to Europe, and as you say, like irons out the shot during his time in Spain and in Serbia to where it becomes something he's confident in. And that, I mean, we had talked about this, I believe, when we did sort of that Mavericks chunk, that play, the confidence in that shot and his willingness to go to it and get it off quick opens up everything else for him. Like, he's on a team also where he's never going to be expected to be the number one guy or the number one ball handler, the number one playmaker. So all he has to do is connect the dots. And he's smart and he sees the floor really well. And he's able to like, all right, you've already bent the defense with the initial action. Swing it to me on the second side. I can do something with that. Now that the shot is there and the defense has to close out on me, I can beat a closeout, get to the rim, and then like shovel pass to the big on the inside. Like, he can keep the machine humming. And to do that, and then also not take anything off the table defensively, because he can guard across multiple positions, be kind of a bodyguard for Kyrie or Luka in terms of whatever the assignment that they don't really want to have to deal with, can bring the ball up the floor. So it's like a few less touches that Luka has to absorb in some of those situations. We were talking about it the other night, like he's bringing the ball up the floor and Luka is setting screens for him, which Luka like never sets screens for people, but like it's a way that they can get into their actions and compromise the defense before they even get started. He adds an element there that I don't know if you necessarily knew what, or how, if that was, it's certainly not what the Jazz were hoping for with the fifth overall pick or whatever, but there's a real NBA role for that guy. And as he's dealing with all those injuries, I don't know that you could have sketched out that this was what's going to look like. So this being a really like, holy cow, it's nice for one of these stories to work out this way kind of situation. It's cool to get one of those sort of out of nowhere, like somebody that had fallen out of your frame of mind. You didn't think you were ever going to really see again, or you weren't sure if you would ever see him matter, has a chance to be a player of consequence on a team of consequence. That's a pretty cool thing.
Jason Kidd compared him to Sean Livingston, who Kidd coached in 2014-15 in Brooklyn. And the trajectory and the similarities are actually pretty striking. Sean Livingston, number four pick in the 2004 draft, 10 years later in Brooklyn, plays well under Kidd, gets a three-year deal with Golden State after that to go be part of the champion Warriors. Dante Exum, drafted 2014, both entered the league at 19, torn knee, much less of a gruesome, crazy situation, but still 10 years later now, under Jason Kidd, doing the thing, setting himself up for a nice, probably three-year contract is what he'll probably end up looking at. Not to say Jason Kidd is the answer, because I think a lot of credit goes to Don. I mean, I was talking to one person who overlapped with him in Utah who said, you know, the Spain part, he went and played for FC Barcelona, one of like the banner clubs of Europe. Dante called it the spotlight without being in the spotlight. And he was thinking all about getting back to the NBA. But then to go to Partizan in Belgrade, where Nikola Jokic grew up rooting for those teams there, where like the fans are throwing flares from the stands and whatnot. It was their first go around in the EuroLeague. Like, people on the league definitely took that as like, oh, Dante's like really trying to put himself and challenge himself in tough positions to really work his way back. And he did it. The shooting stuff, I asked him if there's anything he tweaked to his mechanics. He said no. And I looked on YouTube at like literally almost an hour of Dante Utah Jazz shots compared to now. And the mechanics are truly identical. So what changed? And he said he picked the brains of Alex Abrines at FC Barcelona and Kyle Kurich. If you remember him, Louisville sharpshooter, helped them make the Final Four. And Kurich, when he was there, when they overlapped together, put together back-to-back 50-40-90 seasons. Dante said that those guys just basically said to him, you have to keep shooting. It's such a cliche, but like, it just comfortability, confidence, consistency was what Dante said. And that like, you want to have a number in your head be very high of how many you're going to miss before you lose your confidence. That like, shouldn't just be sniping them. So now he's knocking down 4 of 4. It was against San Antonio, but like a dagger triple with 37 seconds left on Tuesday night, their last game. He plays versus Utah tonight, the team that drafted him. And the numbers before we move along are just kind of crazy. When he's been available this year, Kyrie and Luka actually sport a negative 2.9 rating in 511 minutes without Exum on the floor. When all three of them have been on the court together, and they've been closing games with that lineup pretty consistently now that he's been back. They do a lot of fun horn set stuff with Kyrie and Dante. I mean, it's honestly, they're all interchangeable, but it seems primarily they run Kyrie and Dante at the elbows with Luka up top. But they really can, as you were saying, Dan, with Luka playing off ball and stuff, and that's been part of what they've loved so much about Dante there from talking to Dallas people, the fact that they can get Luka in different situations. With all three of those guys on the floor over 100 minutes, the Mavericks sport a 124.8 offensive rating, which is actually 3 points above when Kyrie and Luka are on the floor without him. It's higher than the league-leading Celtics with a 112.9 defensive rating. That's a level with a top 10 unit that obviously the Mavericks have not really been on the defensive side of the ball. So that three-man lineup, again, small sample size, 100 minutes. They have the best offense in the league, and they're a top 10 defense. So I think we'll see plenty of that down the stretch, plenty of that if they're in the play-in mix, plenty of that in the first round if they get out of that. So there's something to alert our listeners. Dante Exum's back. He could be an X factor for the Mavericks and the Western Conference playoff picture.
If you have any more information that you'd like to get on that, you should go check out Jake's story at Yahoo Sports, which went Good up plug. This morning, Thursday morning. A wonderful read, wonderful art, wonderful access, all those sorts of things.
Thank you. To bring this to a close, we are going to, I started the show by giving gifts. We're going to give the gift of optimism to all the five worst NBA teams. So, Dan, to start with the Charlotte Hornets, they are first here on the rundown. What is something that you are most interested about for the Charlotte Hornets moving forward?
Yeah, it's just that Brandon Miller was worth it, right? And looks like they nailed that. And whatever the next version of the Hornets is going to be, he will fit it and he will help make it work. There was all the jokes sort of before in the pre-draft process with Brandon Miller about like him saying that Paul George was his GOAT, right? And your mileage may vary on that, that evaluation. But what makes Paul George and what has made him such a great player and what continues to make him a great player, and if he gets to free agency, will make him the most valued free agent on the board and whatever, is that kind of like he will take the shape of whatever container you put him in, and wherever you need him to fit, he can fit. And I think that's the outline of Brandon Miller, right? Like, when they had him playing with LaMelo Ball, he was off the ball more. He was, being able to play off of a primary playmaker. The Hornets, when they had both those guys on the floor, the Hornets are terrible. Let's start there. Everyone knows this. They are one of, I think, 29th in offensive efficiency this season. They were like a league average offense with LaMelo and Brandon Miller on the floor. And that's not, anything to do cartwheels about, but you have a primary playmaker who's going to dominate the ball, and you can have a guy who can run off pin downs off the ball, who can create as a second side action guy, who can be a lane filler in transition, a spot up threat away from it. Like, Brandon Miller can work off of all of that. LaMelo Ball goes down. They trade Terry Rozier end of January, and now his usage rate goes up and he's using more than a quarter of Charlotte's possessions. His time of possession goes up. His touches go up. I think only Miles Bridges is getting more touches per game than him. And his efficiency stays pretty solid, and the numbers all go up. And it's something like 19 points, 6.5 rebounds, 3.5 assists on like decent, pretty good shooting for a guy as he's like working his way through the league and becoming a number one, number two option. That's all really encouraging. And then you can do that while also, 6'7" with long arms, being able to do a bunch of things defensively. And the Hornets had like a brief uptick after the trade deadline where they brought in like half a new team and shuffled the deck a little bit, and suddenly they were defending real well under Steve Clifford for a little bit. Like, he has earned the confidence of a pretty crusty head coach, and is somebody who has earned the minutes that he's gotten. It's not just like, well, this guy was a high pick, so you got to force feed him. He makes sense in today's NBA, and in like whatever the vision of the future is for the Hornets, it feels like he's going to, obviously he's going to be a major part of it given the draft position and everything else, but it's you sometimes you have players who restrict what that vision can be, and like, you can't sketch things out in a certain way because that wouldn't fit that guy. I don't think that's Brandon Miller. I think Brandon Miller is the kind of guy where like you are, the Imagineering is like blue sky, whatever you want to do. He's somebody that can fit into all of that.
Not knowing what the future is fine, because they don't know what it is yet. That, you know, new ownership group just brought in Jeff Peterson. What's clear, and what they've illustrated, that this ownership faction to all the front office candidates that they were interviewing before they hired Jeff, as the word is still going on, is that like they want to make this a premier destination in the NBA, which is such a cliche, buzzy thing that everyone says when the new owner takes over and whatever. But I think they actually mean it. And I think that there's really intriguing starting pieces here, not just from the player standpoint, but you know, they did a very good job at the deadline bringing back strong asset pool from the Terry Rozier trade to the Gordon Hayward trade. And they, by all accounts, plan to re-sign Miles Bridges this summer, which will be for way less than the five-year, $180 million mark, by all accounts, that he was going to get before. And what kind of trade chip could that be? Or, you know, just could he continue to grow alongside these guys? The other thing is, like, you mentioned the crusty head coach. Like, I'm not so certain Steve Clifford is going to be gone next year. That's kind of been, like, a foregone conclusion, I think, in the coaching circles, that, you know, new ownership, new front office, like obviously the coach is next, but there's been, I think there's a lot of respect there for Clifford. There's a connection, at least from him overlapping with Peterson in Brooklyn that one year he was a coaching consultant for the Nets. And he just is a very widely respected coach. Like, I remember back before he ended things in Orlando, that people kept saying to me on the phone, like, the Magic just can't tank because Cliff just got these guys defending so hard. Right. And it's true. So I'll just be interested to see what ends up taking shape there, how the front office ends up finishing out. You know, there was all this talk that Matt Lloyd, the number, I don't know exactly what his number is in Minnesota, but a top ranking executive just behind Tim Connelly in Minnesota, was going to be their main target for the number two under Peterson. It doesn't exactly sound like that is the current situation, being that I keep hearing that they are looking at two names still. There's probably others, but I have heard Sergi Oliva from Portland, who was in Philly for a while, was in Utah as an assistant under Quinn Snyder. Now he's an assistant general manager under Joe Cronin in Portland. And Brock Aller, the cap guy in New York, who has been credited for a lot of the stuff with the second round pick pool that they were able to acquire and whatnot. So those are two names that I have heard to just keep in mind on the radar for Hornets stuff. In Detroit, Dan, what are you intrigued about the Pistons, aside from the tough injury stuff that led us to you giving a lot of flowers to Asar Thompson at the top of the show?
Yeah, so the first one is Asar Thompson. Just a last note on him before we move on from it, because I looked these things up and I don't like to waste things I looked up. Estimated plus minus, a stat that I've cited on this show before, Taylor Snar at his website Dunks and Threes adjusts, it's a way to try to measure how much you're impacting the game when you're on the court, considering your teammate, considering your opposition, et cetera. The defensive version of that, defensive estimated plus minus, has Asar Thompson as like a top 15 guy now, like today. The guys right around him on that list are Jalen Suggs, OG Anunoby, Mitchell Robinson, and Rudy Gobert. So in terms of, which is like a pass the smell test in terms of those guys being good in that number, it's like, all right, well, that leads, lends some credence there. And he does that while guarding everybody from, SGA to Franz Wagner to Dame Lillard. So it's, get well soon, Asar. I want to see you again. To me, I mean, the biggest thing, even in a pretty dismal context, which I think it's fair to say this season has been, Cade Cunningham in the second half of the season has started to look like the guy that they hoped he would be. We have had conversations on this show where it's like, is that just a wash, you know, pick? Is that not going, is the context going to make it such that he never gets to the level that they hoped he would? Is he just not the transformational kind of prospect that they thought they were drafting. And in the last couple of months, or since mid-December, so, you know, half the season, 23 points, 8 assists, 4.5 rebounds, 38% on threes. So that's like the big swing piece for him. 39% on pull-up threes. That's been one of the big issues. Like, could he make enough shots? Could he on a high enough volume to open things up some more in that Detroit offense? Among rotation regulars, so guys that are, I think it was like the framing was 15 plus minutes a game, 15 plus appearances. The only guys with a higher assist rate in that span the last 3 months, Tyrese Haliburton, Luka Doncic, Trae Young, who are like the archetypes we're talking about with what Cade Cunningham was hoped to be. Like the all, you know, big orchestrator, see over the defense, make every pass, manipulate the chessboard, and create something on offense. And that's, again, in the context of a ton of losses on a team that has been absolutely dreadful, that's what he's been able to do. And so much again is going to come back to the context. And we talked earlier about the shooting issues. And, you know, if Jaden Ivey can be the shot maker he was a couple months ago, as opposed to the one he is right now, that makes that backcourt more tenable. If Asar Thompson takes a leap there, that makes it more tenable. If they, I don't know, you know, it remains to be seen what they do with Beef Stew, and like if his shooting uptick holds fast, I don't know. But more shot making around Cade, more space for him to play in, those numbers could play up even more. And that level of production that he's managed over the last, you know, 3 months or so, that's the all-star stuff. And if you can get that with a more stable context around him, you know, that could finally be the thing that helps the, you know, the worm turn a little bit in Detroit. It's hard to find too many things to get super psyched about, but that's the thing. Like, nothing else matters if you don't have that guy. And the last few months, he's looked more like that guy than he had to this point in his career.
I'm not psyched about what I'm about to say, to use your parlance, but in the spirit of rooting for past top five picks to figure it out in some capacity, to just stick around the league and find happiness, James Wiseman,
yeah,
I think is going to get, this is just like educated guesswork more than reporting, I think he's going to get another like Marvin Bagley special, where if you recall, the Pistons acquired Bagley from the Kings, and probably no one was going to give him the like 3-year, $30 million deal that Bagley got, 30 plus million. The Kings, the Pistons, excuse me, sent out their first round pick, you know, Sadiq Bey, for James Wiseman. He's playing more minutes now post All-Star break, up to 17 a game. The defensive numbers are decent from an advanced standpoint. When he's on the floor, their defensive rating, 113, which we just talked about, top 10 number for Dallas, not too far off. And just like, I remember when the Pistons were here last, or when I last saw them here at the Garden, him warming up with like coaches battering him with like football pads and working on defensive, like no one works on defensive rotations during pregame shoot around on the floor while the clock is ticking down from 90 to zero. But I saw it with James Wiseman. And if that work is paying off after he got, you know, probably rightfully maligned for not turning into what the Warriors hoped he would become, I will be happy for him. And for the Pistons, if that turns into something Marvin Bagley-esque, where Bagley did actually become like a legitimate backup center type player in this league, not for $30 million, but you know what I'm saying. We're going to move to the last three teams quickly here. With Washington, I'm going to say that at first when they moved Wes Unseld to the front office,
restructuring.
Yeah, there were some questions around the league, like, oh, why is this happening now? Blah, blah, blah. What say you? It does seem like interim head coach Brian Keefe, who I believe was in Oklahoma City at parts when Michael Winger and Will Dawkins, the two leaders of that front office, along with Travis Schlenk, were with the Thunder. It does seem like, by all accounts, he's kind of the leader in the clubhouse right now to get that job moving forward. Seems like he could be the J.B. Bickerstaff in Cleveland, the Jacques Vaughn in Brooklyn before obviously that went wayward. For example, at this point, and maybe I'm speaking out of turn because I haven't really truly checked on this, but from everything I've heard throughout, like Kevin Ollie, I'm not expecting to be the head coach of Brooklyn next year, right? Mm-hmm. Brian Keefe, I think, is a super strong candidate for that to happen. And just little conversations I've had, like I keep hearing people talking about how they really like what the Wizards are doing schematically and what have you. I'm not going to, in the interest of time, I'm not going to run down the list of a team that's losing a lot of games and how great they're doing. But he's at least done enough that I think it's kind of become almost like a consensus in the coaching circles that we alluded to earlier that he's potentially going to be the guy. And if he's not, it'd be like even like a surprise. So positive, at least like building block moving forward for Washington there.
That's interesting. And it calls to mind, you know, you mentioned Oklahoma City. There was that idea of like Mark Daigneault, no one knew or very few people knew who he was or what his situation was. But it was like, that's a guy that we believe will get us sort of formed in the right direction. And then we give him a long enough runway and we build something. Maybe they're hoping for a similar thing here, like get to play the sort of the right way and implement a style and then grow from there. I'm not going to lie. These aren't all going to be winners. But Denny Avdija, shouts out to you. He has gotten more opportunities to do things with the ball and has done more with them. There's caveats to it. You know, a lot of this is happening, like I said, in games that kind of like don't really matter because the Wizards were like 3-17 and basically playing for nothing for months. A lot of it is colored by he had one giant game against the Pelicans right before the All-Star break where he scored 43 points. There's also a question of like, could he be more in still like, a lot of his uptick has come in games where like Kyle Kuzma is not available or is off the floor, is injured or whatever. They're kind of similarly big combo forwards who would be making plays with the ball in their hands. So do they cannibalize one another to some degree? And then if Kyle Kuzma is somebody who is a building block, you know, does that limit what Denny Avdija's contributions could be? But all that said, since Christmas, again, we're talking about like big samples, like 35 games, about half the season. 16 points, 8 boards, 3.5 assists, 56% on twos, well over 40% on threes while taking three of them a game. So like the volume is up there with the efficiency. He's had more 20 plus point performances since Christmas than he had in his whole career before that. And when the usage has gone up, the efficiency has gone up too. Like not at like full on elite numbers, but it's hard to do both of those things when you are shouldering more of a load and also doing it more efficiently. Denny Avdija has been to this point the kind of player where you're like, oh, he's a maybe a 3-and-D or like a defense and some playmaking. And you haven't seen those things, like the offensive components of that really dovetail. He can he defends everybody. He works his tail off on that. And he's like a tough, rugged physical defender. This is the first chunk of his career really where you're like, okay, I don't have to squint so hard to see the outline of somebody who can help a real team. Whether that's a real team in Washington or a real team, someone comes and gets him. He's on starting a 4-year, $55 million extension that's declining salary year over year. So he feels like the kind of guy that a smart team might want to take a run at because they look at it and say, we've now seen him scale up when he needed to. We also know we feel pretty confident he could do some of that in a smaller role while defending for us. Like there's a future there that maybe 6 months ago, I wasn't quite sure what it would look like. He has played himself into a conversation where you're like, I can sort of see that guy mattering in the league here. So that's, again, we're scraping a little bit on some of these. Shouts out to Tyus Jones. Shouts out to Bilal Coulibaly. Get well soon. All these sorts of things. And, you know, we'll see where they go from here. But shouts out to Denny Avdija. I don't know that you're going to wind up on a whole lot of most improved ballots, but you have improved. And that is worth noting.
Portland, I'm just happy that DeAndre Ayton has found the right sleeping situation, being that he apparently was sleeping on an air mattress. He said, quote, I didn't have a bed for quite some time. I was on an air mattress just trying to figure this out. My body wasn't my body. People forget the humane difference of me adjusting to everything. So he's just being comfortable and waking up. So shout out to DeAndre Ayton for being a multi-millionaire whose 4-year, $133 million offer sheet from Indiana was like the story of the offseason for a long time, because every day I remember being in Vegas, I guess that was 22, for Summer League, like texting people on the situation. Is it coming today? Is the offer sheet coming today? because like we all kind of knew it was coming, but it wasn't for option dates and what have you. So I'm glad he finally was able to get the sleeping arrangements that are necessary for him to be dominating out there.
Well, that's, I mean, yes, sleep is key. Having a real bed is important. Even when you're, you know, in your early 20s, maybe not something that you prioritize, but it's a good one to prioritize. And yeah, I think like that's my pick here is like the version of DeAndre Ayton they got the first half of the season was not going to help the Blazers figure out anything about their future. The version that they've gotten the last, you know, since he came back from knee injuries, he was out for about 15 games from, you know, in December and January with knee soreness. Since he got back to that, though, he's actually looked like the player he was kind of late, you know, at the apex of where he needed to, where he was in Phoenix. 21 points, 12 and a half rebounds, 63% from the floor. The rebounding rates have been elite. Like he's the stuff that made you look at him during that Phoenix finals run and say like, why aren't they just maxing this guy out? He's playing at that level. Opponents are shooting 56% against him at the rim, which is, you know, strong mark among like high volume rim protectors. The Blazers have been about 6 points per 100 possessions better with him on the floor during this stretch. Like it's not superstar stuff in and of itself. But when you think about all the questions that the Blazers have to answer and figure out, like they didn't really see enough of Scoot Henderson and Anthony Simons and Shaedon Sharpe healthy at the same time to be able to kind of figure out what the pecking order is and who they, you know, who do you build around in what roles and how do they dovetail and all that kind of stuff. You still have to figure out, you know, they didn't move Malcolm Brogdon or Jeremy Grant at the trade deadline. Is that something that they're even interested in? Do they want to just say, well, let's get these guys together and sort of see what a functional version of this team with everybody healthy looks like? What is Robert Williams' status as he comes back from injury? Where do you find minutes for Chris Murray after you spent a first round pick on him and he kind of spent most of the season on the bench? All that kind of stuff. Like, there's still a lot to figure out here. But Ayton, if you have a legit rim protecting center who can provide 20 and 10 on high efficiency without needing to dominate the ball, that guy can help you figure out the answers. It's like you need the foundation before you can start building the other things on top of it. You would be within your rights to have some skepticism about DeAndre Ayton as that foundation. But if the guy they've gotten the last couple of months is the guy they're going to get moving into next season, I think it makes it easier to build on figuring out what comes next. So in a season where not a lot has gone right, that's at least something. You're getting what you had hoped for in terms of the return for him there. And then if you match that together with a couple other things going right, another high lottery pick, maybe you're in a better position to sort of round out the roster, figure out what you need and where you can get, how you can get it, and what you are willing to give up to go get it. But him providing that baseline hopefully helps them sort of figure out what comes next.
Speaking of providing baselines to help teams figure out what comes next, give me Trey Jones in San Antonio. Two-year, $20 million deal last year. And for all the talk of his brother, Tyus, being like the best backup, but like not good enough to be a starter, I think that conversation probably will end up happening with his brother, who also stands just 6'1 and 180 pounds. Once the games in San Antonio actually have greater consequence. But for now, you know, after the great Jeremy Sochan point guard experiment that made a lot of us lose a lot of our hair because we either pulled it out or whatever, 35 games as a starter now for Trey Jones. And the dude is very dangerously flirting with a 50-40-90 production in that. 54.9 from the field, 41.4 from three, 89.7 from the free throw line. The guy just like figures out how to get the ball to scorers, which is what the fucking role of a floor general is, man. Especially when you have a 7'4" behemoth who should be the easiest player to get the ball to in the history of the game. He's finally doing it. Someone's doing it. And like, yeah, obviously they're still at the bottom of the league, but there's been more and more nights where I tend to like check in the league pass at around 9 p.m. Eastern when the games are in the fourth quarter some nights, because, you know, the boy needs some free time to just like chill and not be thinking about the NBA all the time. And more the Spurs are in these dogfights till the end that are clearly learning lessons for moving forward. That Dallas game that we talked about at the top where Dante Exum ripped out their hearts. There definitely still was fun stuff from San Antonio down the stretch. And I just couldn't help, as much as I was watching that game with my eyes glued on Dante, because that's why I was definitely keyed in on that before I wrote the story that came out today. Again, yahoosports.com. I think it was so striking just to see how much more, because I hadn't really watched the Spurs in like a couple weeks. And I was thinking back to when I saw them here and when I saw them in San Antonio, when it was the LeBron Lakers versus Victor versus LeBron game in like mid-December. And just have so much more of a flow and like an actual process to things, man. It just like is a revelation all of a sudden.
Yeah. I mean, there's a too cute by half component to this where it's like the answer to the most interesting thing about the San Antonio Spurs is the fucking Giants. But you're right. I mean, like noting Trey Jones and noting the role he played, like that was where one of the things that I feel like got, I don't know if misconstrued is the right word. We all understood what it would probably look like when Trey Jones got on the floor with Victor Wembanyama at the beginning of the season. It was like, okay, really high floor, low turnover, table setting point guard. You kind of know what that's going to look like. The goal of those first 20 games was let's figure out what else we could maybe do. And like the experiment of Point Sohan, I wrote a lot about it. I really liked it as an idea. Let's try to expand skill sets. Let's see what other opportunities this might open up for us. If we play Victor at the four and we play a huge point guard and we play 2 7-footers together, what does that look like? And they found out and it sucked. It wasn't good. And it, when they like, whatever, I think it was December 27th, I think is the date that late, they put Zach Collins on the bench. They moved Wembanyama to the five.
17 straight games at one point. That's what ultimately helped switch that flip there.
Yeah. And they decide we're going to make Victor a full-time center. We're going to start playing Trey Jones more. And yeah, like it unlocks the team in a very different way. I know Zach Lowe had mentioned numbers like this and other people have as well, but it's worth citing. When you've got Victor Wembanyama, Trey Jones, and Devin Vassell, who's the third part of that kind of core triumvirate there, and you've got them on the floor together, the Spurs have outscored opponents by 174 points in 730 minutes. They've scored like a league average offense and defended like the best defense in the NBA. It's basically the Timberwolves math. And now they arrive at it differently. You know, Victor is maybe like if you have Ant and Rudy Gobert smushed together in one guy. But the idea is like that's the exciting thing to me is you already have a functional core. And you're terrible, and you have 2 top 7 potentially picks coming in this draft, and then more coming, and then more cap space, and all these sort of, like, but you've already got like a proof of concept that makes sense. Victor is, if he's not, you know, I love the line where he said like, Rudy is a very deserving Defensive Player of the Year candidate now. Let him get it this year because then it won't be his turn anymore. Wembanyama is already one of the most impactful defenders in the NBA, and also somebody who's averaged well over 20 points and like several assists per game for the last few months. You can organize him. You don't need your point guard to be like a 25 point a game scorer if he's able to unlock those other guys. Devin Vassell, since they flipped that switch, as you mentioned, that late December thing, he's like 24.5 and 4.5 on 48, 38, 79 shooting. Like the functional pieces there make sense. And it gives you flexibility. You can say, there's been much made of the question of like, how patient is Victor going to be? And when do they have to start getting after it? Whatever.
That's a nonsense thing to state at game 63 of his rookie season or whatever they're at right now. Like that whole thing. I know Vinny and Howard talked about this on very briefly. Like he's going to be in San Antonio for 7 years. And then we could maybe, but like, and this is where he wanted to go. He didn't want to go anywhere else. He was hoping and praying that he'd be with the Spurs, and they just built this new gleaming practice facility that's going to be all this, the shrine to developing the greatest prospect of all time. Like, he's not going anywhere. It's not going to be. I'm just so, like, as much as my job is to forecast what could happen and the player movement that could happen, like, that is not one thing that is remotely on my radar right now.
Yeah, absolutely. It's premature to have that kind of concern. He's also the kind of talent that makes you start thinking about things fast. He accelerates things. But so the question is, in what way do the Spurs accelerate around him? you know, there was rumblings about like, well, do they look for an upgrade at point guard? Is that a Trae Young team, whatever? I don't know, man. Trae Jones looks like he's pretty frigging good, and they seem to be developing really good chemistry, and there's something worth building on there. If you can go get a home run swing at point guard, awesome. If not, stick with this guy that you have on a real, you know, cost controlled situation that seems to be a really positive player for what you're building. You know, maybe they, and there's the question of internal development. They've got all these young guys there. I don't know. Like, does Blake Wesley's jumper come along? Does Malachi Branham pop?
We said one interesting thing, Dan. Come on.
The interesting thing to me is this is all like teams that are this bad rarely have something this good to build on. They've got something in place that's real. So then how do you build around it? And do you decide like, we got to go all in and trade picks for present day help, go and spend max money on somebody? I don't know. I think that finding out what they think of where they are will be interesting. But the fact that you've got already like a real something serious to build on right away is, I think, it makes them a compelling team. Like, there will just be no bad teams in the West by like the end of next year if these things pan out. Like, all of your easy wins are gone essentially, like in year two of Wembanyama. So it's going to make that whole conference more of an insane bloodbath. But we'll get there when we get there.
We'll get to more stuff next week, because that's all we've got for you today on this episode of No Cap Room. Thanks to super producer John Gennaro, as always, who does all the things to make this show look and sound great, and the video team and the social team and everyone else behind the scenes making this thing a multi-platform beast that Ball Don't Lie is becoming. Subscribe to Ball Don't Lie on YouTube and whatever podcast platform you're currently listening on, and give us a 5-star review. That'd be great. We thank you for listening, and we'd appreciate it if you came back again next week for another episode of No Cap Room.